You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SF Youth Community Radio Station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
What is very relevant to what happens on the 7th of October is the last group of people who were pushed into the new refugee camp that Israel created in 1948 called the Gaza Strip. And I have found in the Israeli archive an order called Order Number 40 from the 25th of November 1948. And the order says very clearly, like so many other orders during the Nakba, occupy the villages, burn the houses, and expel the people to Gaza. So this is the main, I think, historical context we should tell people about.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on Gaza in context. Gaza's 2 million plus Palestinians are jam-packed in a small, narrow enclave bordered by the Mediterranean Sea, Egypt, and Israel. Since 2007, it has been ruled by Hamas. Hamas is an Arabic acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement. Israel immediately imposed a blockade. Since then, Gaza has routinely been called the world's largest open-air prison. Its air, land, and sea were controlled by Israel. On October 7th, Hamas attacked Israel, resulting in over 1,100 Israeli dead and the taking of several hundred hostages. Israel, with one of the world's most advanced militaries, responded. Today, Gaza is in ruins. Palestinians have been killed and wounded in the tens of thousands. It has become, the UN says, a graveyard. How did this catastrophic situation develop? How did Gaza become Gaza? Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa and was chair of the Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies in Haifa. Today, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including 10 Myths About Israel. He spoke at the Bint Jebel Cultural Center in Dearborn, Michigan, in mid-May 2024. And now, Ilan Pape.
When the Secretary General of the United Nations reacted to the events of the 7th of October by saying that we should remember that there is an historical context for what happens on the 7th of October, whether you condemn everything that was done or partly was done, or you don't condemn, it doesn't matter, he said, you have to understand that this attack by the Hamas was not done out of context, or as he put it, it was not done in a vacuum. And immediately he was condemned as being an anti-Semite by the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and the government of Israel demanded that he would be dismissed as a Secretary General of the United Nations. And then followed an incredible reaction by university management in some places in Europe, some places in the United States as well, almost forbidding people to use the word context as if this was equivalent to a slogan, killing the Jews, or something similar. The fear of being taught about the context is very indicative in the way the West, and especially the United States, has dealt over the years with the question of Palestine. So this kind of reaction by usually quite intelligent and educated people who forbid their students, their colleagues, their communities to talk about the history of Palestine, to talk about the context of Palestine when referring to the events of the 7th of October, were understood in Israel as a carte blanche to do whatever they want and exploit the events of the 7th of October to perpetrate the genocide that still goes on today, and in many ways try and complete some of the project of elimination that they were unable to complete in 1948 and ever since 1948. So I think it is important to talk about the context. And I think it is important to demand space and time to explain the context. One of the things we don't do and we shouldn't do is tell people, give me a minute or two, and in one soundbite or two soundbites, I'll explain to you why anti-Semitism is not anti-Zionism, why the Palestinians' resistance is not terrorism, why Israel is an apartheid state, and why it should be treated as an apartheid state. You cannot be content with saying these slogans if you don't have the ability to explain why these statements are valid. So you have to learn the history. You have to know that history, because what these kinds of statements represent is something that to many people's ears sound like heresy, like something that they have never heard before and contradicts everything that they have been hearing about Israel and Palestine from the mainstream media, from their politicians, from the university professors, and from the public discourse about Israel and Palestine in general. So this is very, very crucial. This is a point where our understanding of history stops being a pursuit of intellectual interest that has to do with some people who like to write about history and therefore they chose the career of historians or like to teach history. History, in the case of Palestine, is a crucial key for understanding what goes on today and what should happen in the future. And therefore, it is not only a matter for experts to deal with it, but everyone who is part of Palestine, feels about Palestine, wants to do something for Palestine, has to know that history, because it is such an important way of explaining to others why we are doing what we are doing for the sake of the liberation of Palestine. And that history goes back more than 120 years from today. It doesn't start in 1948. And you have to be aware of the kind of intellectual, theological, ideological world in which Zionism was born to understand what's going on in Palestine today and should happen in the future. Many people do not remember or know that Zionism, to begin with, was an evangelical Christian project. Long before any Jew was thinking about Zionism, leading Christian, what we would call today Christian Zionists, in those days we would call them evangelical Christians of certain denominations, on both sides of the Atlantic, were advocating the establishment of a Jewish state, knowing very well that there were other people living there, but thought that the creation of a Jewish state would precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, would bring the end of time. And eventually, in the mid-19th century, convinced the most important empire in the Middle East, Britain, that this was not just a theological good idea, but also strategically Britain should benefit if it will make Palestine first British and Jewish. And again, this deliberations about the future of Palestine in the mid-19th century were done where people knew very well that Palestinians were already there. Not only that they were already there, but that they had a thriving society, an urban elite, a pastoral rural society, an organic human body that if you were talking about removing it or replacing it with a European Jewish state, you could only do it by force, and you could only lead to the demise of the people living there if this is your either religious idea or your strategic idea. And then it was towards the end of the First World War that these two impulses also influenced the Jewish communities, especially in Eastern Europe, that were suffering from anti-Semitism and were looking for ways of dealing with a world that did not accept them as equals. And they were convinced that maybe the best way of dealing with that kind of persecution was to build a Jewish state in Palestine. This was not a majority opinion of most of the Jews. It was a minority opinion. The religious Jews felt that this was contrary to the Jewish religion, to have a Jewish state before the end of time. Liberal Jews believed that the only way of dealing with anti-Semitism was to have a more liberal democratic world. Socialist Jews believed that the socialist revolution would make everyone equal. A small minority believed that you have to redefine Judaism as nationalism in order to solve the problem of anti-Semitism and also in order to modernize the Jewish people. A very important landmark in this transformation happened in the United States. In 1918, in Pennsylvania, the American Jewish community that until then looked very suspiciously at the whole idea of Zionism, very small minority of American Jews until 1918 thought that the idea of building a Jewish state in Palestine would solve the problem of anti-Semitism. But in 1918, under the influence of the British Zionist lobby, a new body was created, the American Jewish Congress. And that Congress adopted the idea that the British had put forward through the infamous Balfour Declaration that said that actually the West, including the United States, sees the establishment of a Jewish state as fitting the values of Western civilization. Yes, they added a condition that it would not undermine or damage the interest of what they called non-Jewish minorities, as if the Jews were the majority in Palestine in 1918. They were only 10% of the population. But they said the non-Jewish minorities, namely the indigenous native people of Palestine, that their interests would not be affected. But of course, they knew that this was the only way of establishing a Jewish state was by undermining the lives and future of the indigenous people of Palestine. This meant that with this kind of alliance that developed from the beginning of the 19th century and culminated at the end of the First World War, the alliance that faced the people of Palestine, which I'm sure most of them had no idea that such an alliance was formed. How could they know that this was happening? But by 1918, already a very powerful coalition of forces was determined to turn Palestine into a Jewish state, while most of the Jews didn't want to come to Palestine, and fully understanding the implication of such a project for the people of Palestine. This was a coalition of British policymakers, American policymakers, leaders of evangelical Christianity, and other interested strategic allies. So Palestinians from the very beginning were facing a problem that had nothing to do with them, that Europe and the United States decided should be solved at their expense, knowing pretty well that this could lead to the destruction of Palestine and the Palestinians. How could they treat the Palestinians in such a way? Well, we owe a lot to the way our dear and old and deceased late friend Edward Said helped us to understand Orientalism, the way that Europe perceived Arab people, Muslim people, Christian Arabs, even Jewish Arabs, perceiving them as less equal than the Western European or American person. So that kind of Orientalism helped to dehumanize the Palestinian to the extent that when you were discussing the project of building a Jewish state in Palestine, you didn't care at all about the position, the aspiration of the people themselves. I'm not saying that everyone in the United States or everyone in Britain or in Europe disregarded the Palestinians. There were voices that from the very beginning warned the policymakers that such a project would have disastrous consequences, not only for the people of Palestine, but for the whole relationship between the United States and Europe with the Arab world. One of them was the American consul in Jerusalem, Selah Merrill, who warned the State Department that such a project would not only bring disaster to Palestine, but would turn the United States into the enemy of the Arab world and the Muslim world. And he was quite a prophet in that prediction. The moment this coalition enabled the Zionist project to begin building a Jewish state, once Britain occupied Palestine in 1918, the moment this became a fact, an established fact, there was an inevitable building or process that led to the 1948 Nakba. The way the British mandatory authorities, as you know, Britain ruled Palestine between 1918 and 1948 for 30 years. The way they treated the Palestinians was like they treated any colony in the empire. But they didn't treat the Jewish settlers in the same way. They allowed the Jewish settlers to build military power, economic power, political power. So Britain was very much complicit in the project, not only of building a Jewish state, but building a Jewish state at the expense of the Palestinians. First of all, at the expense of their aspirations, but as we learned, also at the expense of their existence. And today, when we expanded our scholarly interest in similar situations in the world, we found the similarities between the way European settlers treated indigenous native people, including in this country, dehumanizing them, believing they had the right to eliminate them in order to make way for creating new political entities. And the elimination of the Palestinians was motivated by the same ideologies that led to the eliminations of the Native Americans, the First Nations in Canada, the First Nation in Australia, in New Zealand, and to the way the Africans were treated by the settlers who came to South Africa. This is still a sentence that in so many places you cannot say. And this is absurd because it's so valid, logically, morally, and historically and academically. But you cannot say that easily everywhere. You know, the Zionist movement is a settler colonial movement, and hence all its action in Palestine were motivated by what scholars of settler colonialism called the logic of the elimination of the native. And I remember when I suggested my book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, to my publisher, he said, I cannot publish a book with such a title. You cannot accuse Jewish people of committing ethnic cleansing. And I said to him, but if we don't put it in the title, the whole book is not worth it. Because that's exactly my contribution. I'm not contributing to the facts. Palestinians know exactly what happened to them. And people who didn't know what happened to the Palestinians would know through my book and others. But I said to him, far more important for me for telling what happened is to analyze what happened, to frame what happened, to explain that this is a crime, and we know who the criminals are, and we know that they were not brought to justice, and we know that the crime continues. I wrote it in 2006. I didn't know that the crime would reach such levels of brutality as it does today. I thought that 48 was the peak of Israeli brutality. Who could have known that they would outdo their brutality in 2023, 2024? So it sounds like a very logical sentence, but I want to say that outside this hall, this is still something we are fighting for. For telling the truth about Palestine, and telling the truth about Palestine is not just telling what exactly happened, but also using the right language to describe what happened. So if you're talking about ethnic cleansing, you're talking about politics of elimination. And if you're talking about politics of elimination, you understand that the people who decide to eliminate another people do not treat the other people as human beings. It's dehumanization. And we had all kinds of chapters of dehumanizations in human history, including against the Jews in Europe. But it's unthinkable that in the name of what happened to the Jews in Europe, we are not allowed to talk about the inhumanity inflicted on the Palestinian by an ideological Jewish movement. We should not be afraid of doing it. I know. It's not easy, because we immediately would be accused of anti-Semitism. But as long as we know the facts, as long as nobody could refute our both academic work and our logical work and moral work on Palestine, we should not be afraid to use the right language and not subject ourselves to the language that the American media is using to explain what's happening in Palestine. So that kind of ideology that was supported by the United States, supported by Europe, supported by evangelical Christianity, and by Jewish communities around the world, created this political and military system that waited for the right historical moment to translate the logic of eliminating the Palestinians into an actual ethnic cleansing operation. And this is where the Gaza Strip comes into our story. Gaza, until 1948, was a town, not a strip. The villages and towns around Gaza were not part of a strip. They were part of a district. They were not a huge refugee camp. In fact, until 1929, there was a Jewish community as well in Gaza. In 1905, the rabbi of this Jewish community, Rabbi Azulai, and the imam of Gaza wrote together a letter to the Turkish government complaining about Zionists and Christian missionaries that try to deteriorate the relationship between Jews and Muslims who live together in Gaza for centuries, without any kind of animosity, discrimination, or racism. This was the kind of Gaza that existed until 1948. Israel created the Gaza Strip in 1948. And this is an important fact, because when Israel started the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, ended with the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages and most of the Palestinian towns, it was able to push Palestinians to the north, to Lebanon and Syria, and to push Palestinians to the east, to the West Bank and Jordan. But they were not able to push the Palestinians in the south to Egypt. Egypt refused to allow Palestinians to enter the Sinai Peninsula. So what could Israel do? He didn't want the Palestinians. So the leader of Israel, Ben-Gurion, decided we can give up a small part of Palestine in order to push hundreds of thousands of Palestinians into a strip. And you could look at the border of the strip. It's like a ruler. It's a rectangular. It's an artificial rectangular that Israel created at first 650 square kilometers. Then the Israelis thought they were giving too much space to the refugees, and they cut it into 350 square kilometers, making it one of the densest refugee communities in the world. But the whole idea was to create, intentionally, a huge refugee camp so that demographically, the Palestinians south of Jaffa, south of Halil, would not be included in the Jewish state. And this was unfortunately done with the agreement of the Egyptian government at the time, the Royal Egyptian government, because it was part of the armistice agreement between Israel and Egypt that was signed in January 1949. What is very relevant to what happens on the 7th of October is the last group of people who were pushed into the new refugee camp that Israel created in 1948 called the Gaza Strip. These were the people who lived very near the strip but were not inside the strip. On the ruins of their villages, Israel built the very settlements that were attacked by the Hamas on the 7th of October. These were the people who were dwellers of villages that have been wiped out in the months of November, December 1948. And I have found in the Israeli archive an order called Order Number 40 from the 25th of November 1948, and that order enlist the names of these Palestinian villages that are gone. And the order says very clearly, like so many other orders during the Nakba, occupy the villages, burn the houses, and expel the people to Gaza. So this is the first generation of the people of Gaza. Yes, of course, the young people who came into the Operation Al-Aqsa flood were third generation of refugees. But they were very much aware of the history of their grandparents and their parents. So this is the main, I think, historical context we should tell people about. But this doesn't end there.
You're listening to Ilan Pappe on Gaza in Context. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
After 1948, and especially after 1967, the fate of the people who live in that huge refugee strip that Israel created is closely associated with the fate of another geopolitical unit that was created in 1948. That did not exist, people don't know it, did not exist before 1948, the West Bank. The West Bank was, it's not a term that anybody knew about before 1948. There was no West Bank. Jenin and Haifa were organically connected. Nablus and Jaffa were organically connected. Jerusalem, the hinterland of Jerusalem, were what we call today, the, was what we call